The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
And welcome to Ladies Who London podcast. I'm Emily Dell.
And I'm Alex Lacey, and we are qualified London Blue Badge tourist guides.
Each week we bring to you some of the best bits of London.
We talk about our favourite people, places and events with a bit of information, a lot of laughs and a whole lot of fun.
We can be found on Instagram at Ladies Who London podcast and on our websites guideemily.com
and alexlacey.com for information about our upcoming walking tours and virtual tours, as well as what the Blue Badge guiding qualification is all about. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Yeah, pretty good. I've been doing loads of baking this week, which I love. I kind of got to the point of going, just want to bake. So I've been making tons of stuff for all my neighbours. They're getting loads and loads of delicious stuff. But yeah, apart from that, not really much, I guess. Quite a quiet week this week. How about you?
Yeah, pretty quiet. Although we did go to a garden centre on Sunday. I know,
it was like, the dream.
What an absolute treat. So we got a couple of plants. I think it took us about an hour to kind of decide on what plants we should get to put on the balcony. But we got there in the end.
Good.
And we've gone for some camellias.
Amazing. Fabulous. That's what we like.
Yeah, so...
Spring is sprung. The grass is riz.
Spring is sprung, exactly. So that was nice. You know, it's the little things that you start to appreciate. You know, like the idea of baking and things. It's,
yeah.
You know, but yeah.
Embracing the lockdown baking. It's all good.
Embracing the lockdown. Yeah, because you've been doing banana bread, which a lot of people have been getting.
Banana bread and cookies and all sorts of stuff. I've just been loving it. Oh, hey, there we go.
Tasty.
So, welcome back, everybody. This is kind of turning into just me and you catching up now, isn't it? And having a little chat about stuff.
I know.
I'm okay with it. You know, I'm sure that the format of this is going to change massively when lockdown finishes.
Oh, God, yeah.
But for the time being, it's just quite nice to have a little catch-up, isn't it?
It is.
Well, welcome back, everybody, to Ladies Who London podcast. We're thrilled to be back with you again this week. And last week... I really, really enjoyed last week's one on Virginia Woolf. It was fantastic. Mm. Did you get some good feedback from people on that one?
I did, yeah. A lot of people saying that they didn't know that much about her as an individual. Knew a couple of her books, and someone said they knew a film that she'd been in, but the intricacy of her mind, I guess.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah, I didn't know anything about her, so it was really fascinating for me. And so we need to figure out who won the podcast pedestal from last week.
Oh, right, here we go then.
are you not feeling it then?
No, I am not.
Oh, no.
No, I've looked at a couple of the votes. And somebody did message in a vote for me, I believe. So make sure that you get that one down.
Okay, I will add one back. Actually, no, I think it was a vote for me. It was Rachel who...
Oh, damn it, you're right. It was for you. For heaven's sake.
Oh, dear. Oh. Okay, right. Well, I'll just put you out of your misery.
Yes, let's gallop over this as quickly as we possibly can.
So the novel, which I think was a great choice. Great shout.
Do you know what 20... it was? What did you, yeah, go for it?
20 votes for the novel.
20 votes for the novel?
Yeah. And the library got 57.
The library got 57. Sorry, how many votes did I get? 20. Jesus Christ. I mean, Orlando is just such a classic. It says so much about her personality, says so much about the people in her life. It is known as the longest love letter ever written. But to be fair, the way I described her sitting outside of the library was pretty good.
Are you taking that as a win?
Can I take that trophy, please? For my... my description, the visual aid that I gave you.
Yes, I mean that's a joint win right there. I'm gonna let you.
No, congratulations, Alex. Well done.
Thank you.
So now the score is.
Sorry, is... I'm not laughing. I'm not laughing because you've lost.
You're cackling. Again. That's what you're doing.
I'm not laughing because you've lost again. It's just your face. You're completely
evil. Look at you. You're so sorry. You're almost slapping your leg.
Oh dear!
So
I'm very
currently
sorry.
It's 10 to me. I am in double.
You
digits.
Are in double figures, yeah.
But it's 12 to you. So now it's 10. Now it's 13-10.
13. Unlucky for some.
Oh, what happened in
not
13-10?
What happened in 13-10? Oh goodness!
Boom.
13:10, just before lunch. Right, well, let's get on with this week's podcast, because then you will feel a lot better about things.
Let's move on swiftly.
Let's move on to that. So this week, the wheel landed in Liverpool Street / Shoreditch. And again, there's, I mean, a ton of stuff that we could do in that area. But I've gone in for something good and dark again, which will speak to your sensibilities, which you do like, which is Bethlehem Hospital, otherwise known as Bedlam. Mm. And there's a couple of places we could have picked for Bethlehem Hospital, but I sort of thought Liverpool Street is the perfect one because that's where it starts out. Mm-hmm. So how much do you know about Bethlehem Hospital or Bedlam?
I know more about the one that was over in Southwark and about some of the horrible treatments that the patients went under. So I know more about the latter years of Bedlam. So I'm quite excited to find out how it all started, really.
Interesting. Right. Well, cast your minds back, if you will, to the 13th century. 1247, if you want to be specific about things. And this is when Bethlehem Hospital is founded. And I don't want you to kind of think of hospital the way that we think about it today, to start with anyway. Think about it more as hospitality. So it's about putting people up, and particularly it's about looking after people in need, the poor, the hungry, those who've got nowhere else to go. And it starts out very simply on a slightly kind of, it's actually on a bit of land that has been donated. It's a charitable thing by a guy called Simon Fitzmary. So Simon Fitzmary donated a chunk of land, and he had, he was quite big into the Bethlehem and the Virgin Mary. He'd been on crusades and all this sort of thing. So he was quite into all this stuff, and he'd become quite a wealthy political figure. He was actually the Sheriff of London twice. So from fairly sort of humble beginnings, he kind of gets himself up into the upper echelons, and he decides that with his newfound wealth, he's going to give a chunk of land to this particular place to create this hospital, which was named after Bethlehem. Simple as that. So Bethlehem Hospital, and it was a priory to, like so many hospitals, this is where, you know, we see a lot of hospitals and charitable institutions coming from priories and religious institutions. And so this one was the Priory of St. Bethlehem, and it was this medieval hospital. So like I say, hospitality, it is putting up people, a refuge really for anybody who needs you know, a roof over their head and care, and people would turn up there. And it was quite small. It covered just about 2 acres. It was one story, and it was quite kind of compact. And you had a courtyard in the middle, which had a chapel in it. And then there were approximately 12 to 15, what they call cells, for patients. And there's a kitchen and staff accommodation and all this kind of thing. Now,
sounds quite nice.
I mean, it does actually sound a little too bad. Now, at this point, I am just going to interject and say, I'm going to kind of say a trigger warning here for because we are going to be talking today about mental health. We are talking about people who, and I will be using kind of historical terms that we wouldn't use today, like mad, and all of these terms I'm sort of putting in quotation marks, mad or asylum or crazy, and all these sort of words. So I just want that to be a bit of a trigger warning for people that we are going to be discussing that, and I am going to be using words that at the time, you know, would have been used, but we don't so much today. So whenever I'm saying words like crazy or mad, please imagine I'm doing them in quotation marks, because ultimately that is how we're sort of referring to it today. So gradually this hospital becomes, they start to specialise in caring for people who aren't just poor, but who can't take care of themselves. And this is where they are considered mad. And in... by the early 1400s, patients that are referred to as lunatic are the sort of the majority of what the patients are in Bethlehem Hospital. And so essentially this becomes England's kind of first, what we're going to call, mental institution, and also will eventually become the most famous, or I probably should say infamous, actually. So over the years, this becomes less and less religious. And in the end, the hospital's sort of struggling to survive. And so the City of London takes it over. And one of the reasons for this, the fact that it's kind of got a future with the City of London, is the fact that it has this specialisation in madness and mental illnesses. But they do also treat other people, people with learning disabilities, with dementia, and also a thing that's called falling sickness, which is basically epilepsy. So they start to look after people like that. And gradually, bit by bit, it becomes more and more well known. And the name Bedlam, or Bethlehem, which, you know, people sort of shove it into the word of Bedlam, the word Bedlam starts to become known. It's like a sort of a byword, really, for things that are crazy, that are mad, chaotic. And the most difficult patients are called stark bedlam mad. So there we go. And so it starts to become a kind of byword for not just insanity, but chaos generally. And we still have that word today. If, you know, if kind of running around and there's all sorts of stuff going on, I say, oh, it's bedlam, absolute bedlam. And that's where it comes from.
Wow. So it's been, that's been going for quite some time.
Yeah, so hundreds of years.
Yeah, wow.
And I'll explain a little bit later how that idea of it being kind of chaotic and busy and crazy and all that sort of stuff comes into common parlance, because you would think that it's inside the hospital, people aren't going to be seeing that, but oh, they do. So we're just going to have a little look at what makes it such an important spot. The whole thing is rebuilt in 1676. So the previous one, as I mentioned, is quite small. There's only a few patients that you can take. But it was rebuilt in just after the Great Fire of London, and it shifts slightly over towards the Moorfields area. So it's not too far away, This is a much, much bigger site. And it is created, and this is where it becomes a real part of British particularly London, really, society and kind of consciousness, because they don't just build a building that is functional and that is useful to keep patients in. They build what is essentially a huge, very opulent looking palace type building, to the point where it is actually compared to the Palace of Versailles. This is how amazing it looks. Yeah. So it would have been incredible.
So it's the kind of place that you wanted to get into.
Yes. And I should point out, this is only from the outside. So this is quite key. The sort of place that, you know, you'd go along and you'd say, oh my goodness. And there are stories that people were sort of taken there and said, oh, you know, look at this amazing building. What do you think it is? And someone would go, oh, it's clearly where the Lord Mayor of the City of London lives. And they'd say, no, it's an asylum. And they'd, you know, there was a guy who actually said that the design of it makes you wonder whether the persons that ordered the building of it or those that inhabit it are the maddest. So... you know, you've got this incredible building. I know, it's great, isn't it? It's got an incredible building. It looks amazing. And you turn up and you go, oh, this is an asylum for mad people. And everyone's like, why? Like, the two don't seem to go together. And at one point, actually, somebody does describe it as, for many years, being the only building that looked like a palace in London. And it was referred to as a palace for lunatics as well. That was sort of the you know, the strap line really. It was designed by a guy called Robert Hooke, who, if anybody knows anything about St. Paul's Cathedral or post-Great Fire of London architecture, he was a colleague and assistant to Christopher Wren. So, you know, he's got chops as well. And he properly went for it. Like, he decided, okay, we're just going to go all out on this building. Huge, long frontage to it with turrets and columns, Corinthian columns, these beautiful kind of ornate ones. Huge, huge manicured formal gardens and tree-lined sort of spaces to walk and this kind of thing. And it's said that he was inspired by the Tuileries Palace in Paris. So there's a lot of this kind of French influence coming in and them going, oh, let's make this amazing building that's essentially going to be a hospital for mental illness. And the entrance as well had these two human sculptures on it, one on either side. And they were, you know, clearly very obviously suffering. One was called Melancholy and one was called Raving Madness. So as you're kind of going into this building, you know, even that above your head is doing that.
So what about the area of Moorfields? Would the palace have stuck out like a sore thumb, or was Moorfields quite an affluent area back then?
No, it would have stuck out like a sore thumb. And one of the reasons actually that it was built is, if you think about it, we're talking 1674. What's happened recently? Great Fire of London, 1666. So it has devastated the city of London. And one of the things that London, particularly the city, was like, it was these tiny little alleyways and warrens of wooden timbered houses, and they were dark and they were, polluted and all this sort of thing. And so one of the things that London wants to do is to compete with places like Paris and other cities that are rebuilding in grander styles. And so know that this building was properly, you know, stuck out like a sore thumb. And it was huge, and it was very, like I say, very palace-like. And people were, very impressed with it. And it was this kind of move towards trying to make London a grander city that was nicer for everybody, and part of this thing about, you know, creating institutions that are useful to help people as well. But there's another reason why it's built.
As a patient.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, as a patient going in thinking that, oh, wow, this is actually going to be really lovely inside. And then just suddenly the horror hits you of where you're going to be placed and live in.
Yeah, and I should say that the it's beautiful on the outside, but on the inside, it's very, very different. And there's another reason why it's built as well. There's, you know, it can only take a few people at the asylum. So there's loads of other private asylums that are opening up. It's particularly, and this kind of does continue, even when the new one is built. You see a sort of rapid expansion in London's population and the need for more and more spaces. And in fact, the new Bethlehem Hospital only has space for 120 patients. So still not a huge amount. And this really long list for admissions. So all these private, again, in quotation marks, madhouses start appearing everywhere. And, you know, some of them are really quite abject and they're basically kind of prisons, for want of a better word, unregulated. And this, essentially, when families have a rather inconvenient member of the family who's got some issues, they can just lock them up there and not worry about it. So by building this new incredible building, this gives them a USP, and so they can beat the competition, basically. So, it's all about financial gain as well.
Well, I was going to say, would the patients have to pay, or would their families have to pay for them to actually be placed inside the hospital?
That's a very good question. It's always been a charitable institution, so they have raised money through other sources. So no, as far as I'm aware, it didn't cost to go there. The private ones, yeah, they may well have done, but this one is a charitable institution. Okay. So you have this incredible building, which looks amazing, really beautiful, but you get problems with it from the very, very start. And this huge ornate facade that's on the front is so heavy that the back of it just cracks. You get rainwater running down the walls. There's no foundations. And essentially from the minute it's built, the whole thing is this collapsing, breaking mess from the very start. And what you're doing is you're sort of slapping a sticking plaster over what the locals really saw as a kind of quite a grubby problem. But yeah, essentially it's all It's all fur coat, no knickers, I think we've said before.
Yes, and it was just reminding me of, you know, like Wide's Globe in Leicester Square, where you think it's, you know, it's quite mesmerising, but look a little bit closer and there's cracks and the paint's all chipping off.
Exactly. And yeah, it reminded me of that as well when I was kind of reading all this, because it does strike me as that thing of, look at all this, amazing, and then actually just don't look behind the curtain because it's all a bit, falling apart. And so this is what you get. You get this building that, again, is not really fit for purpose, but it looks pretty. And so therefore it's, you know, it's commanding quite a lot of attention. And it becomes a bit of a local, well, not a local, but a London landmark. Visitors would come and see it as a day of touristing. And this is where we linking slightly back towards the Joseph Merrick episode, where we're talking about freak shows and sideshows. And it's a very similar thing. People come and visit the hospital, and we don't quite know, the numbers are debated about how many people went every year. There are some sources that say it was tens and tens of thousands of people, and that it was the second only to St Paul's Cathedral in popularity, but it's a little bit difficult to kind of nail that down and whether that's accurate or not.
Second to St Paul's?
Yeah, I wouldn't reading. Necessarily take that as gospel.
Take that as gospel. Uh-huh. You know, but people would, it would be part of their day out. You know, they'd go to the Tower of London, they'd see St Paul's, and then they'd head over to the hospital to essentially look at the patients as if, that they were animals.
And it's not even just looking at the patients as well. So one of the things, the hospital is encouraging this because they're benefiting financially from it. And it's said that they could raise up to about £450 a year, which is a lot of money for the hospital. And there's all kinds of little backhanders as well. So staff can get a little bit of extra money if they get bribes for private tours and access to cells and wards and things like that. So there's a little bit of backhanded stuff going on. So it becomes very much a kind of, a slightly corrupt system at the hospital. Mm-hmm. And we'll come on to that a little bit later. But again, it's part of this kind of this freak show thing and this idea that, oh, let's go and have a look at these things that we just don't understand. And for as little as a penny, you could go into the wards there and you could stare at the inmates, but you can also shout stuff at them. You can taunt them. You can abuse them. You can try and sort of goad them.
What?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, you can kind of try and goad them into reacting or throwing stuff. And of course, you've got a whole variety of different people there. You've got people who are suffering from depression, who are suffering from things like schizophrenia. You know, there's been all sorts of mental illnesses, mental issues going on there. So people are going to be reacting very, very differently. And so this, it's just, it's unthinkable, really, but this is what it is. And this is where we get the term bedlam coming to mean complete chaos. And if you sort of think about it, really, one of the things that they're doing by allowing people in is they're sort of trying to remind people as well that, you know, how to keep yourself. You do the right things, then you know, if you don't, then you'll end up in here. And there's this sort of line between madness and sanity, and it's there's all these works of fiction. I mean, there's so many works of art that come out from about bedlam.
William Hogarth's, isn't there?
Absolutely. And he does go Hogarth does go and visit Bedlam Hospital, and he would, I mean, he then goes and he uses Bedlam in The Rake's Progress in particular. And he's, I mean, we know Hogarth, he loves to wax lyrical about the things in society that you should and should not be doing, and telling you, oh, don't do this and do that and blah, blah, blah. And one of them is this, The Rake's Progress, one of his most famous, where this chap comes over and due to kind of excesses, he ends up falling in society and ends up in Bedlam. So he's using it to sort of say, look, all these excesses, just be careful because you'll end up in the nut house otherwise, which is pretty,
In that picture as well, by Hogarth, there's like a coin, an image of a coin on the wall with Britannia. So it's kind of like, the society, it's the society that people are living in that makes people go mad.
Exactly.
And not that they're born mad.
Yeah, and that's another of his, the things that Bedlam kind of becomes a byword for British society. So that's why Hogarth is using that coin, because it's sort of being said that it's I guess, a marker, a staging post for what is happening in British society. So the whole of that picture is going, oh, look at this crazy thing that's all happening here. And this is, it's not just here. Look at this thing on the wall. It's the whole of Britain that's going a bit mad. And, you know, we know Hogarth and his love of, moral virtue and all that kind of stuff. And there is one guy, actually, we can turn to. And, you know, as well, if you think about it, there are so many sort of works of fiction and plays and things. I mean, even Shakespeare, who would have been around in the time of Bedlam, but the previous Bedlam, not this very big kind of luxurious one. You know, he talks a lot about in his plays about, you know, you see so many of his characters turning mad. Some little thing will happen and they'll flip and they'll go mad. And then you have the characters and their entire sort of raison d'etre in these plays is about, it's about insanity, it's about being mad about something. It's there's a lot of works of art, fiction, all this kind of thing that's coming out of this as well. And I want to just mention one chap. It's a guy called Ned Ward who used to write a diary, and he visited Bedlam in 1699, so it'll be in this new building. And he writes about it, and he says that he was just kind of terrified by what he saw and he heard. And I'm just going to read this little quote to you. It said, "We heard such a rattling of chains, drumming of doors, ranting, hollering, singing and rattling, that I could think of nothing but a vision where the damned broke loose and put hell in an uproar." So that's quite a big statement.
That creates a bit of a vision, doesn't it?
It does. And other parts of his diary, he does talk about how he's seeing, and I think he actually takes part in sort of taunting these patients through the bars and through little holes that are cut in the doors and things like that. And some of them are being verbally insulted, some of them being stuff thrown at them or spitting at them. And they're trying to get them to react and all this kind of thing. So it's really full on.
It's so much like a zoo, isn't it? You know, like if you've got a lion or something and you're trying to get its attention, and it's not okay, but you think it is, to kind of like, you know, make a noise and bang on the glass to try and make it react.
Absolutely.
Awful.
It's really full on. And, you know, it becomes this place where there's so many people visiting, and it's this kind of just, well, chaos of noise and smell and all this sort of stuff. You get people who are going there for business too. So you get prostitutes going, you get pickpockets, you even get food vendors and people who are selling like souvenirs and trinkets and stuff like that as well. So it kind of, you know, where people are, that's where you'll get your tradies. You get your people who've got stuff to sell, that's where they'll go.
Really did turn it into an attraction. I mean, if it was here today, or in the same manner, you know, you'd think it would be on the, what's that ticket you get that you can go to Westminster Abbey, the London Eye, and also head to Bedlam.
Yeah, it would be. Yeah. And what they find is that particularly when it gets to sort of parts of the year like Christmas and Easter, what am I trying to say? Sort of festival days, really, you get vast numbers of people and you get actually overcrowding at these times. So, you know, it's clearly a sort of thing of, right, Christmas, let's go and see the mad people at Bedlam. It doesn't bear thinking about today, really.
No, it doesn't. It's cool.
And we get people such as Samuel Pepys, the diarist, and Dr. Johnson, and all sorts of people. You know, it's really the place that people go.
And gosh, Pepys, honestly, I'm surprised he had any paper left. The amount of places that he went to and wrote about.
I know, but it's just, you know, I guess it's thanks to people like Pepys that we have really good eyewitness accounts of things like this.
Absolutely.
And of course, so this building, you can tell it's not particularly habitable. So as it gets ever more kind of crumbly and stuff, they end up shoving the patients closer and closer together. And so there's lots of violence, and you've got patients who are chained to their beds and their walls and all this kind of thing as well. So it's pretty awful. And you start to get reformists coming in who are arguing that the patients need calm and quiet and they don't need visitors there and all this kind of thing. And this does eventually start to happen. And I'm going to come back to that in a little bit because I want to tell you what it was like inside the hospital. So I'm sure you can imagine it's not great. It's not particularly fun. It's not comfortable. And the regime there is basically, it's kind of punishment. They have this sort of idea that mad, they hold this belief that madness is a disease of the body, not the brain. So it means that you can kind of use medicines and methods to cure and sort of purge these, what they call melancholic humours. You know that health in bygone years was just down to humours, different humours, and if they were out of balance, they could, you know, cause all kinds of illnesses and this, that and the other. So madness or mental illness was down to melancholic humours. And so it thought that you could purge that out of the body by having, by sort of inflicting really bouts of vomiting and diarrhea, bleeding, bloodletting essentially, blistering of skin. So they would literally blister skins. They would place the patients in things like cold baths as well. So there's a couple of really big treatments that I want to tell you about. There was one chap who used to be a sweeper at the hospital, so a cleaner basically, and he said that he used to be a patient there and that he was lucky because he was lashed to his senses. So clearly, you know, the thinking was, whatever the illness is, with deprivation, with punishment, with pain, with chains, this kind of thing, it will eventually leave your body. So
you've got to get that trauma out.
Exactly.
In the most, horrible way.
And there's three big kind of therapies that they use. One was called rotational therapy. And this is by developed by the grandfather of Charles Darwin, Erasmus Darwin. He devised this kind of rotational therapy where basically you'd be put in a chair and the chair is suspended from like a hook or a beam in the ceiling with ropes attached to the legs. And the chair would then be turned sort of 20 to 40 times. I mean, it's the kind of thing you did when you were a kid on the swings. And, but, you know, tighten it all the way up.
20 to 40 times, Ali.
That's a lot. God. Yeah, I know. And then it would be spun. And then it would basically be released. And it would spin back to its original position.
Oh.
Yeah, I know. It's mad, isn't it? And I mean, it's fun when you're a kid. But after, one or two of those, you want to vomit all over the place. And it's only a couple of rotations.
Yeah, especially if, you know, you're already going through all sorts of different things mentally and physically as it was, and then to suddenly be spun like that. Oh no.
And how long do you think that you would be able to do that for without, you know, wanting to
without
fall
passing
over
out?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. Maybe a minute.
So Erasmus Darwin recommends that it should be 3 or 4 times a day for the duration of a month, and each time should be an hour or two.
Oh, an hour or two.
So you could be spending 6 hours being spun in a chair. Be awful.
And do you know if they would take the patients out of the chair straight away to give them that kind dizzy sensation when they were...
No idea. And it was kind of seen...
Left them there all day.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I guess so. It was seen that it was a really good way of kind of taking the pressure off the brain and the nervous system, and that also that it would induce restful sleep, which frankly I think it's more likely to make you pass out. There was another one which was cold water therapy.
Gosh, yeah, I mean, they probably all, you know, fell into unconsciousness and they thought, oh good, you know, it's worked, they're asleep, lovely.
Yeah. Probably just knocked them out. Yeah. So cold water therapy. Now, this is something that obviously people do, athletes and things do, for muscles that need, regeneration and stuff like that. And if you've worked out a lot, an ice bath would happen. And you'd be in there for like a minute or two and that's it. But here in Bethlehem, Bethlehem Hospital, patients could be put in this cold water for hours at a time. And they'd be wrapped in towels that have been soaked in ice and they'd be sprayed with cold water. And that, again, is supposed to be a therapy. And then there is also bleeding and purging. So, I mean, we see this a lot with medicine. You get leeches and stuff like that to leech out these bad humours in the body. Mm-hmm. But this is even more so. So you get bleeding, you know, bloodletting and things like that. But there's also, they enforce vomiting and diarrhea and stuff like that as well. So this is, yeah, it's really quite miserable to be in there. And you can imagine that on top of somebody who is depressed or psychotic or whatever it might be, it would just not be fun at all.
Well, as well, you know, after they're having this treatment, like let's say they're having this, you know, this bath for God knows how long and they're freezing cold. It's not like they're going to be taken to a lovely room after and they're going to be wrapped up and they've got a lovely bed. It sounds like, you know, the whole place was just was just one big awful treatment.
Yeah, it was. And, you know, there's no heating there either. There's no hot water. There's no kind of glazed windows. It's cold. Yeah, I mean, I think by going into Bedlam, you're probably more likely to die than you are to be cured, I think, realistically. And, you know, death was something that would happen. And they would just see it as, oh, well, you know, that was the sort of the natural outcome of these things, rather than, oh, we've brought it on by chucking them in a bath full of ice for hours on end. So we get to the sort of mid-1700s, 1750, and there's a group of reformers who, you know, they've been... People can go, they can see what the conditions are like there. And these medical reformers decide that they're going to do a progressive alternative. And there's a hospital called St. Luke's Hospital is built directly opposite Bethlehem Hospital. And there's a chap called William Batty, who is the chief doctor there. And he actually comes out and says, all of these things that you're doing, bleeding, blisters, cold baths, vomiting, all of this, he comes out and he publicly denounces it and says that the way that we are treating is to remove anything from the patients that are known to cause their disorder, whatever the problem might be. So they don't allow visitors. They don't allow, they don't do this kind of punishment of treating. They deal with the patients with quiet and calm. And of course, which we know now is the sort of thing that people need when they're dealing with mental health stresses. And the guy who's in charge of Bethlehem Hospital, a guy called John Munro, massively disagrees with this. And he comes out and says, no, I've never heard of any bad effects from any of these things and blah, blah, blah. And they both publish books and they battle quite publicly, actually. And yeah, it's a really kind of testing time. And the patients at St. Luke's are dealt with it by individual diagnosis. William Batty believes that mental illness, there's not just one form, there's a whole variety of different things, and he wants a clean, calm environment. So that's what he sets out to do. And you know, in that, that as well as the belief, is the vast difference between these two hospitals. Which is really quite
having them opposite each other.
Yeah.
As a patient, you go in, you know, I want to go over to St. Luke's, please. But hang on a minute, I'm being taken into Bethlehem. I mean, wow, two polar opposites.
Yeah. And so where we have William Batty creating this rather amazing hospital, Bethlehem starts to come under a little bit of scrutiny. And there are a few asylums that are found elsewhere in the country, which starts this kind of reformist movement inside Parliament as well. And legislation is kind of up and coming. And the governors of Bethlehem, who are generally pretty kind of high-flying folks, so they're up in the upper echelons, they manage to use their influence, which is, yeah, pretty big influence, to get the hospital exempted from any kind of scrutiny from outside. So all these other asylums around the country are starting to be looked into. They're starting to be, you know, the conditions that the patients are kept in. But Bethlehem manages to not have that. And eventually, there is an MP called Edward Wakefield who manages to get into Bethlehem, into the wards, and the staff have been trying to put this off for weeks and weeks and weeks, and eventually he gets in 1814. And immediately he can tell why. Because the building, this is where they see this cold building. It's dark, it's dirty, there's no hot water. You've got these cells that are inhabited by several people chained to the walls or chained to their beds. And they're, you know, there's feces on the floor. Some of them are stark naked. In fact, there was one particular woman called Anna Stone who was... they're essentially shackled to the bed, completely naked, covered in her own dirt. I mean, it was really awful. And there were patients that were found to be kind of crippled with the cold and all this sort of thing. And one of the people that comes out of this report that he discovers in this is a chap called James Norris. And James Norris is described by this committee that go as being clear and lucid man. He's been chained by his neck to an iron bar in the wall, and he's got extra restraints on his feet and waist and chest and all this sort of thing. And Norris tells them that he has been there for a decade and that his muscles have atrophied because he's basically been shackled to the wall, a variety of different, you know, by your neck as well. You're not going to be able to, you know, to move at all if your neck is shackled. And essentially his muscles have atrophied. And the staff there, they say, oh, Norris is dangerous and he's violent. But the MPs, they say, well, to us, he seems completely normal and perfectly sane. So it's a very big deal. And they call for a parliamentary inquiry into the hospital. Now, this is where stuff starts to kind of get a bit real for Bethlehem Hospital. There's this inquiry. The medical staff do not come off well at all. They all kind of start blaming each other, saying, oh, it's so-and-so, their problem, that it's all squalid and whatever. And the doctor argues that there's nothing wrong with it. He says, no, it's absolutely fine. You know, there's nothing wrong with it at all. Mad. And the surgeon, who was apparently a drunk guy, had just died a couple of weeks before, so he, you know, escapes all of this completely. So the medical staff, the parliament,
what, like the surgeon at Bethlehem,
yeah he's died and got out of it basically. So the medical staff are dismissed, but the governors stay in place, and they immediately kind of pretty much reappoint the same people. And this really annoys all the reformers, but crucially not the House of Lords, because again, they're sort of all linked in. So the House of Lords actually block attempts to bring Bethlehem under official regulation. So they've managed, by their considerable influence, to basically swerve any kind of scrutiny, regulation, anything that would be good for their patients. They've managed to swerve it. It's really quite appalling. Yeah.
That is terrible.
It really is. So,
especially like the people like Wakefield, who was the first MP to go in there. He must have been just enraged.
Yeah, absolutely.
Was, you know, this was able to continue.
Yeah. He was, and he kept calling for reform as well. And in 1815, Bethlehem moves from the Moorfields one, which is, like I say, collapsing completely, to the one in Southwark, which is the one that you said you knew a little bit about. And they've learned a few lessons. So it's a new building. And in fact, if you go to the Imperial War Museum today, that is the very building that was used for Bethlehem Hospital. So it is the same building that's on that site. It's an amazing building, and you can look at it and you go, oh yeah, that's structurally sound, which, let's face it, is a massive step up for the hospital.
Yeah, it's a strange one, isn't it? When you're walking through the War Museum, already the kind of things that you've got on display at the War Museum kind of sends shivers down your spine anyway. But just to think of all the people that are in that space.
Yeah, it's quite weird.
Yeah.
So when they move, what's really good is that they bring in new staff members, and they do create some of these reforms that have been being called for. And a few years later, there is a report that says, you know, the patients are kind of clean and supplied with everything they need, really. And it suggests as well, because up until one thing I haven't mentioned, and I could go on about Bethlehem Hospital for hours, but one thing that it came under scrutiny for was mismanagement of funds as well. People were kind of creaming off money from the funds as well. So this then, it says, the hospital is now solvent and it's pretty well managed. But it's not the end of the problems. We have a few little, they're quite big, but they're sort of individual problems, really. And one of the biggest ones, like I say, I could talk about this for hours, but I'm not going to, because, you know, nobody needs that. But they find a guy called Edward Wright, who's the apothecary there. And they find him one night in the female wing, female galleries, and he's drunk and his clothing is, you know, all over the place. And they kind of looked into Wright, and one of his colleagues reports that he's generally kind of smoking, and he's opening and taking off the heads of the dead patients occasionally. And it comes out, it's properly just horrific. It turns out that he has developed this kind of weird sort of obsession with dead bodies, and he's created, get this, his own kind of Frankenstein style laboratory in the basement of the hospital. Yeah.
Gosh. I mean, I know you like to call me the goth guide, but I think that is overstepping the mark.
Yeah. If you pick him for your podcast pedestal this week, Emily, then there's no hope.
Jesus Christ. What's his name?
No, it's I'm not telling you. He's obviously dismissed. And there's a couple of other little bits and pieces that happen. But eventually, it kind of doesn't, because those things don't concern the treatment of the living patients, only the dead ones, Bethlehem is still exempted from legislation that is passed in 3 different years over the next sort of 20 years. It's huge. And eventually, and so it's kind of operating still under its own steam and kind of doing what it wants, eventually reformers get louder and louder and louder. And in 1853, their exemption is revoked. So at this point, outside inspection is now something that has to be done. And after 600 years of basically operating on their own and doing whatever they jolly well want, suddenly they have scrutiny and they are under the legislation that every other asylum is under. So there we go.
And who was it still the Monroes during that time when
Do you know what? It was when they sacked all the staff and then rehired them, it was the next Monroe down who was brought back in as the head. When they moved to Southwark, I'm not sure. I don't know whether or not it was still the Monroes, but I would suspect it might have been. I didn't actually look into that bit, but I suspect it may well have been, or at least somebody tangentially linked to them. Yeah.
I can't believe how long it took.
I know, over 600 years for them to go, actually, you know. And I think probably it was because it was it had this influence from all these governors and all these people who basically had friends in high places, as simple as that, you know. It's awful. A couple of people who were there, one of them was the sort of a porter guy who used to work for Oliver Cromwell. He was known as Daniel. And he, when he was there, which would have been the mid-1600s, he was one of the most famous patients of his time. We don't really quite know what was wrong with him, but we do know that he was 7 feet 6 inches tall. So that may well...
Placed on the rack.
Sorry?
Placed on the rack.
No, amazingly not, actually. One of the things that he... We don't know exactly why he was locked up there, but one of the things that was apportioned to him was that he was a supposed prophet. So this might well have been enough to lock him up and say that actually, you know, you're seeing things, you're hearing things. But he predicted the Great Fire of London, interestingly.
Oh.
So there we go. And another one that was a very famous member of the inpatients was a guy called Augustus Pugin. Do you know that name?
Yes, so he did a lot of the tracery around Parliament.
Yeah, he did.
Around the Houses of Parliament.
He did. He did all the kind of the twiddly bits, and it's said that project sent him mad. So he ended up in the Southwark version of Bedlam as well.
Wow.
And believe it or not, Bedlam, or I should say really the Bethlehem Hospital, still exists today. It was moved in 1930. It moved out to Beckenham in Kent. Mm-hmm. And it is now a very well-established and very well-respected hospital for mental health.
Well, I should bloody think so.
Yeah, absolutely. And there is a museum that's linked to it. It's called the Bethlehem Museum of the Mind. And it was opened in 2015. And it was within the hospital grounds, actually. And it was opened by Grayson Perry, the artist who, of course, you know.
That would have been fabulous to see. Is it still there now?
Oh, yeah, it's still there. It's a permanent museum now. And it's got a collection of all sorts of archival stuff and historic objects. And all refers to the treatment and the history of kind of healthcare for mental health. Throughout many things.
And not shying away at all from its dark and evil past.
Yeah, because, I mean, you can't. It's so...
No, you can't.
Bethlehem is so out there to the point where we have the word Bedlam and that's where it comes from. So, no. They are very...
I wonder if there's still a little stigma attached to it. You know, if you are a patient, go in there at the back of your mind thinking, well, I've heard the stories. I wonder how I'm going to be treated.
I don't know. I'm not sure about that. I mean, it's clearly a very, very different place to what it once was. So, I wouldn't have thought so. But yeah, it's quite interesting. There's a history behind these sort of things as well.
Oh, such a huge history behind Bedlam. Like, who would have known? God.
There we go. So that's Bethlehem. Bethlehem Hospital, or Bedlam, as we know it.
So, Alex, that was really good.
Full on, isn't it? But it is
so full on.
Yeah. And like I said, there's more that I could talk about, but we could be here for hours, so I won't. But, you know, there's...
Yeah, no, you've painted such a clear picture of it all.
So there we go.
Yeah, just the idea of people going in to see them and try and make them react, and it just makes you really uncomfortable, doesn't it?
It's an uncomfortable history, and I kind of like dealing with uncomfortable history because I think it's the sort of stuff that needs telling. So there we go.
It says a lot about yourself, how you personally react to it as well, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the same way that I deal with the history of slavery and stuff like that, is that it is history, it needs telling. And by telling these things, we gain a better understanding of a whole variety of other stuff and how to look at things and how very rarely are things black and white. There's a lot of grayscale in historical people, places, events, things like that. And it's, I like the uncomfortable history.
Absolutely. Yes, me too.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place. Podcast Pedestal.
So, Podcast Pedestal, there's a couple, well, so much that jumps out as being the crux of this story. There's so many figures, especially near the end, of MPs like Wakefield and people going in, the reformers that are trying to change things. I think for me, the rotational chair, the way you described that, just kind of sets a tone of what this place would have been like. So I'm tempted to go for the rotational chair.
Yeah, rotational therapy. Yeah, it's
rotational therapy. Okay,
it's quite a good one for imagining the sort of level of hideousness that they would have gone through, because we all know what it's like to be on one of those chairs, and they're great fun for a couple of spins and 5 minutes, but you know, 20 to 30
not
times
an hour.
And then
and
hours at a time, not fun at all.
No, so I think I'm gonna go for rotational therapy.
Good one. Fab. Well, I'm going to go for the diarist Ned Ward, because I think that little quote that I read you is so evocative, and the rattling of chains,
really
drumming
is.
Of doors, ranting, hollering, all of that. You know exactly what that sounds like. You can just imagine it, and it is a thing of nightmares, isn't it? Really. And I, again, diarists, I love them because they are the people, rather than it being a fairly sort of staid history, you get these guys going, hey, I was there, this is what it was like, I saw it. And so he's not a diarist I've come across before, so I might have to have a little rummage for him a bit more. But yeah, I think I'm gonna go Ned Ward, because his account of it was so evocative and so kind of clearly an eyewitness account. So there we go.
Just captured it really well. Yeah, I think that's a really good one. I think it's going to be a bit of a close call this week.
So those are your choices, everybody. We've got Ned Ward and we've got the rotational therapy. So don't forget to come and vote. How can people
vote? Please be aware, I'm three behind. So they can vote on Instagram. So they'll see that we're going to put up the polls on my Instagram, Alex's Instagram, and the joint Instagram. But also you can email us, you can message us. Any way you want. Send a carrier pigeon. Just let us know your vote.
Yep. Attach it to a bunch of flowers, which is then delivered by a hunky young chap. Yeah, absolutely fine.
Oh, lovely, with some cupcakes. Yeah, if you want to do that, no problem.
I've got the cupcakes
sorted. If you want to bury your vote in a cupcake and the challenge is to, you know, find it, then I'm all in for that.
Like one of those hideous gender reveal things, but except it's a vote reveal.
It's a vote reveal. Yeah, because even if I lose, I've got a cupcake. So yeah,
well, exactly. Win-win.
Win-win.
Fantastic. Well, there we go.
The Wheel of Destiny.
So it's time to figure out what we're going to be doing next week. What do we have for the Wheel of Destiny. Have you got the wheel ready?
Got the wheel ready. And I think I want to talk about a woman. I spoke about Virginia the other day, and it made me think I really have not spoken about women at all, really, on our podcast. So I'm thinking I might choose another lady, if you're all up right for that.
Yep, sounds good.
So I'm just going to let the wheel do its thing and then just see what happens.
See who we can pick for that. All right, let's go for it then.
Okay. Right, off we go. Oh, it has landed in Bankside. Now, have we had Bankside?
I don't know that we have, actually. Ooh, no, I don't think so. That's good, because that's a really juicy area with plenty of stuff.
Gosh, that is juicy, isn't it? Because you've got the Tate Modern Gallery, so I could pick any small minority of artists
or women, but
yes,
yeah, you can
not
do that.
Not that many to choose from in there, but there are, yeah, some amazing female artists that have shown work there. You've also got the Globe.
Yeah.
And, oh, actually, I might do an actor.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Ellen Terry.
Yes!
She was a very well-known Shakespearean actor, 20th century.
And you're being a bit tangential because she obviously never performed at the Globe itself, but let's go with it. I don't care.
No, not at the Globe that you can see there now, but in terms of a place where Shakespeare would have roamed and...
Yes, let's do it. Ellen Terry, yeah. Genius.
Okay, yeah. Brilliant. Ellen Terry.
Fantastic. Oh, brilliant. And so that's nice because we're upping the melancholy quota because it's been a bit dark the last few weeks. We're going to bring it back.
Bring it back.
Bit of showbiz.
A little bit of showbiz, a little bit of shaky. Yeah.
Fantastic.
Great.
Amazing. Well, that's it then. That's it for this week. And we have it planned for next week. Ellen Terry. I can't wait.
Good. Well, thank you so much for this week, Alex.
Thank you.
Remember to vote, everybody. And thank you so much, as always, for tuning in.
Yes. And we will see you next week on more Ladies Who London podcast with Ellen Terry. Have a great week, everyone.
Can't wait. Have a good week. Bye.
Bye.